Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Buenas tardes a todos. Muchas gracias por estar aquí. My name is Peter Florence and I am honored and thrilled to be in Cartagena. We are going to spend an hour with the phenomenal Irish novelist John Boyne, and I would ask you first to just join me in welcoming him to Colombia.
Thank you. Gracias.
John, we are here to celebrate the publication of this book, which is called El Pacifista in Spanish, and is a novel set in what we Europeans like to call the First World War. You are familiar with historical context, but aside from the centenary of this great conflict that ran from 1914 to 1918, what is it that we now can write about that period that enables people to see it afresh?
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Firstly, thank you for coming out. When I first had the idea for this book, I was watching a news program on the BBC about a town in England where they were erecting a monument with the names of all the soldiers from that town who had died in the First World War. And their descendants were there watching this, and we're talking about it. But there was a second group of people there, and they were the descendants of conscientious objectors, of soldiers who had been shell-shocked and ran, and maybe been shot by their own side, young men who were all killed by their own soldiers, by their own side. And when I was watching this, and I'd read a lot about the First World War, I love First World War novels, I thought, here was a story that I hadn't read before. I hadn't really read about conscientious objectors. And for a long time, I had wanted to write about gay characters in a novel. I'd never done that. And it occurred to me that I'd never read about what it would be like to be a gay soldier in the trenches during the First World War, the intimacy of the trenches, the horror of them, the manner in which people would be forced into closeness, emotional, everything. And for me, with novel writing, It's just really a light bulb moment where you think, that's what I have to write next. That's what I can do. You know, I'll write about that, and I'll try to tell the story of this war in a different way. The other side of it was the notion of trying to spend as little time as possible in the novel in the trenches, and I liked the idea of two characters after the war sitting in a cafe, just talking to each other. You know, I've written a lot of books which take place over lots, you know, like a century or two centuries in lots of countries. And I liked the idea of getting intimate on it and just conversation, you know, just one day. I thought that would be an interesting way to approach it.
Your gay character is gay at a time when it meant what?
Well, it was illegal, for one thing, and it wouldn't have been that long since, say, the Oscar Wilde trial. And if you were found to be committing homosexual acts, you would be jailed for it. So there's that for a start.
And socially wholly unacceptable, because part of the beauty of the failures of relationships in this book is the impact of his homosexuality on his own family.
Yeah. The interesting thing about that time, if you take the two characters in the book, and the difference between then and now, is that the narrator, Tristan, he's sort of come to terms with this fact in his head. You know, he's realized since he was about 14 or 15 who he is, and he's been dealing with that. He's been exploring that. And he's ready to fall in love with somebody. The other character has never thought about this, because, of course, it's not in the culture. You know, people don't... Now, of course, you know, we read books, we see movies. It's a normal part of life. For Will, in the novel, this is something he's never thought about, something he's never experienced. And if Tristan is awakening something in him, it's something that he's never imagined to be there. And I thought, you know, these two characters, they're at a different place on their journey. One is totally ready to accept it. One is not, even if he is drawn to the other one. And where Tristan, for example, is much more interested in a personal relationship than in the politics of the war, Will is much more interested in the politics of the war. And that's where they're always going to clash, because they just can't find that middle ground.
And there's another wonderful juxtaposition of the relationship that happens to be about two people who are in the same place, and the way that the relationships between the people who are at war and the women who are back home, both sets of relationships are totally impossible. So it's a generational crisis as well for the idea of romantic love.
Oh yeah, it's completely impossible, completely impossible. And you know, if they were to, you know, really act upon their feelings and declare them, well, they'd probably be shot. You know, they'd certainly be jailed. There's no way they could go back to England and have a relationship. And you know, you look back at those years and the way that people suffered, their whole lives, their romantic lives, and our lives. The most important thing in our lives, really, is the person we fall in love with, and you know how the intimacy of that, who we share our life with. And to be denied that, to have that blocked for you, is a tragic thing. And a story like this is always going to be a tragic story.
And it's also going to be about stories, because part of the historical perspective we have now, and I'm trying not to give away an important part of the ending of this plot, but even as you say, you move between the reality of training in Aldershot, which is an army base in England, and the trenches in France. You move between those two realities for the soldiers and the conversation that happens in 1919, the year after the war, in Norwich. And can you just explain the significance of Norwich to people who aren't from England?
Well, I was a student on a creative writing course at the University of East Anglia in Norwich under Malcolm Bradbury, who many of you might have read. And I was very young when I did that course. I was only 23, and it was a very formative year of my life. And I went back 10 years later to teach on the course, and I still go back to Norwich quite a bit. So it's a city I know, and everything I have in my life in terms of my writing really begins there, I think, under Malcolm.
But it's also provincial. It's deemed as being a safe, conservative society.
Yeah.
It's very much about proprieties.
Yeah, it is. And I think the fact that, say, the character of Marion, who's Will's sister, her fiancé breaks up with her simply because she has a brother who has declared himself a conscientious objector. He's worried that nobody will come to his family's shop anymore. You know, business of economics there. And that's a city, that's a town in that time which would not have been able to deal with the effect of a young man from that town putting his guns down when other young men are being shot by the other side.
And the part of the story that is about the conversation between Tristan, who is returned from the war alive, and Marion, the sister of his dead friend, is also always going to be about how the story is told, isn't it? It's not just about what happened, it's about how that has impacted.
Yeah, I knew when I started the book that I wanted a narrative voice that was filled with regret and shame and remorse, and I wanted the reader not to know what he felt so guilty about, and that when he would go to meet Marion for this day in Norwich, you would know he has a secret that he wants to tell her, but you never know whether he's going to be able to tell her. He doesn't know whether he's going to be able to tell her, and in fact, we don't even hear him actually telling her. And I thought that would be an interesting thing. The other important part of those scenes for me was really the nature of Marion herself, because I had made a decision about 3 or 4 years before. I had looked at the books I'd written, and I felt that I wasn't writing very strong female characters, and I wanted to fix that. And so I wrote a book called The House of Special Purpose, where I wrote what I thought was the first strong female character that I'd written. And then The Absolutist followed it, and she is really strong because, of course, she's a woman out of her time. She's highly intelligent at a time when women's intelligence is not valued. She's not allowed to vote because she's not 30 or married to a landowner. you know, when Tristan says to her at one point, because
or,
she's working...
Or has a university degree, or has which a university is the other degree, qualification.
Yes. When Tristan says to her at one point, because she's working with soldiers coming back from the front, that she could have been a nurse. And she points out, well, I could have been a doctor. Yeah. And she's a brittle character. She was great fun to write in a dark, tragic story. I never quite knew what she was going to say next, you know. And I think she drives the narrative more than anybody else in the book.
Now, one of the realities about writing about the First World War is that you are going to have to step into that territory, which most readers know from poetry, interestingly, yeah. Wilfred Owen's poetry, or from a German perspective, All Quiet on the Western mm-hmm. Front, the book by Remarque. You are going to have to deal with trench life. Now, I'm assuming that, like many of the rest of our generation, you know the literary work, but I understand that you also looked very carefully at individual soldiers' letters.
That was the starting place. I read as many letters as I could from soldiers, both at Aldershot and when they went to the front, and the letters coming back from their families. And what I was trying to find was, I was trying to find how the tone changed and when it changed and what it turned into. And what I found was that at the start, and this won't surprise you too much, I think, but when they were training in Aldershot, of course, everybody thinks it's a great lark and they're having great fun. And, of course, the deeper they get into the war, that changes. But the other thing I found was that soldiers at the start would tell stories to their families about the other soldiers in their battalion. They were always telling stories. And as time went on, they would stop telling stories and it would become very internalized. And it would be really just about them. And you would see that tone change. And I would see in the letters back from their families, who might have, over three or four letters, have formed a relationship as such with Jones or Smith, who their son has told them about. And then they're saying, well, what happened to Jones and Smith? You know, because you're not telling us anymore. And the more involved you get in those letters, the more that you read them, the more I felt that I would get Tristan's voice right. I wanted it to sound like it was a guy who was really there. So those letters were hugely important.
Just in terms of Tristan's voice, there's an act of ventriloquism, isn't there, when you're writing about a very specific time and a very specific class. Because Tristan, crucially, although he becomes a writer through having to tell his story, he's the son of a butcher. He's yeah. not a hugely privileged, educated man, and yet he's a book lover.
Yeah. Most of the characters in my books, particularly the characters in the children's books, are all book lovers. They're always reading. The children in my children's books are really the most literate children there ever was. They're eight-year-olds reading David Copperfield and The Cider House Rules and things. The tone was something that... I wrote a novel about 6-7 years ago about the bounty. And that was narrated by a 14-year-old who had no education at all and goes on this voyage. And the story was, because he had no education, it's just wild. You know, he makes up words and it's like an explosion, I thought, on the page. And the novel after that, The House of Special Purpose, was a Russian emigre in his 80s for whom English was not his first language. And sometimes I think novels are written in opposition to the one you wrote before it. So I went from the wildness of Turnstile and the Bounty to this elderly, educated Russian emigre who was going to speak in a very elegant way. And I needed to do that. I wanted to change it. And then so when I came to the absolutist, it was all about the feeling of just shame and self-loathing. You know, I wanted that to run through it all the way. And yes, he is the son of a butcher, but he has gone to school. And even as a young man, he's reading. And it's clear that he wants to write. So he has that spark inside him. So he's a little bit more, he's a little bit smarter than perhaps he would have been, you know, in real yeah. life.
There's a wonderful line in one of the conversations between Tristan and Marion, where he describes that, and I'm misremembering the exact quote, but the basic principle he says is that all of us sit on some point of the spectrum between pacifism and, wonderful line, unremitting sadism. And even as we read him saying that, we know, because we've been witness to the horrors of the trenches, that he's deluding himself, in that you don't sit at one point on that line, you lurch up and down it, that spectrum. When you're now in the 21st century writing about that attritional, dreadful trench warfare, what can you say to make it vivid that is not in the contemporary accounts?
I think it's the act of barbarity that the English soldiers commit against the German soldier when they capture him. Because actually, outside of an early character in the book who's killed quite early, Arthur Wolfe, there isn't really any pacifists. Will himself, who puts down his guns, is not a pacifist. He actually believes in the war and what he's doing there. He's there because he believes in it. He puts his guns down because he sees that they are not fighting according to the rules, that they've killed this young man just because they could, when he was unarmed and they should have taken him captive. And what he objects to is the fact that nobody will take responsibility for that. Nobody cares. That human life at this point means nothing to anybody. It's like, what does it matter? He's dead. We're killing people all the time. And nobody else, Tristan, cannot understand. He can never get his head around the fact that it doesn't matter. If you are in the act of war and shooting soldiers, when you're going over the top and so on, that's what you're there to do. But taking an unarmed, innocent young boy and shooting him just because you can is something completely different. But it's not pacifism. It's humanism.
But what's re... No, it's not pacifism. I'll come back to this, but let's just... It's not pacifism. This book in Spanish is called El Pacifista. Mm. And in German, it's got a fantastic title, and it's called... Die späte Verständnis von Tristan Sadler.
The Last Confessions of Tristan Sadler.
But in English, in the language that you wrote it, the word is more than pacifist and subtly different to pacifist, because Will becomes not a pacifist but an absolutist.
When I came across that term, of course we all understand conscientious objectors and where that comes from, but there were conscientious objectors who would do things like work on farms or work in hospitals or be stretcher bearers or whatever. Absolutists would do nothing. They would put down their... They would just refuse to do anything at all. But everybody in this book is an absolutist. They're extremes, because it's not just Will. Tristan's romantic ideals, his passion for Will and his refusal to let this guy alone, really, at times, is absolutism in itself. He will not be set back, you know. And Marion is the same. She is... she refuses to be treated like some silly girl. You know, she demands that her intelligence and her voice be heard. So the three characters, I feel, have this in common, that they're extremes in that.
As does the terrifying sergeant, actually, as does his father.
That's
they're
true.
All absolutists.
Yeah.
And the most extreme, in some ways, absolutist is Will's father, the vicar, mm-hmm. who has an orthodoxy behind his absolutism, which is useless in the face of what has happened after the war.
And I think you could also say that Tristan's father also has it, because he would rather see his son killed by the Germans than see his son be gay.
Yeah. You have, just flipping back to the point we made before, you have, whilst presenting Will's perfectly logical, rational, and deeply held conviction of pacifism, his absolutism, you have put it into a context of contentiousness. It's not immediately clear that we, the reader, are being invited to agree with him. Mm. We're given the context where several of the other characters, and there are no characters in this book whom you automatically empathize with. You've brilliantly conjured reserves in our relationships with all of them. But many of the characters who are in the front line say, effectively, it doesn't matter whether we kill them with gas or drone strikes or guns or nooses. The genocidal horror of this conflict is not about method. We're all doomed, and in that sense, Will's heroically held belief is profoundly questioned. I mean, you're not actually inviting us to...
I'm not inviting you to agree with either of the characters, because I wanted you to get to the end of the novel and feel, as I did, that... feel, you know, ambivalent about both of them. That you, Tristan is the narrator, and usually in a novel, it's his story, usually the reader is on the side of the narrator. But he's a guy who does some pretty bad things along the way. And he's not the most likable, but he's also, at times your heart goes out to him, I think, but at times you think, this is really actually quite a selfish human being. And Will is the same. And I really feel when you're writing novels that they should, you know, they should reflect real life. And we're all like that. You know, none of us are saints or, you know, monsters. That we all do things at times which we're ashamed of, and we do things we're proud of. And, you know, we all know people that we're, you know, uncertain about. And that's how you should feel with a novel. I don't like it to be all tied up. You know, I like people to feel that they don't quite know how, you know, what their response to it is, and that you can talk to someone else about it. I mean, reading and then sharing a book with someone else, discussing it with someone else, is a great joy. And I've had people read this book and say they hated Tristan. And I've had other people read it and say, you know, that they were just... their heart went out to him. And I don't think it's the writer's job to direct the reader to feel anything. You know, I remember, you know, not to sort of drag myself back to this subject, but with Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, I remember one of the criticisms, one of the many criticisms of that book, was people who would write to me and say that I was asking people to feel sympathy for the German boy instead of the Jewish boy. And my response was always, I can't direct who you feel sympathy for. If you feel the sympathy there, that's you as the reader. I can't do
that. You're being disingenuous. Of course you direct. You are the omnipotent creator. You manipulate the reader's response.
No, I don't think I do. I don't think I do manipulate the reader's response. The only manipulation I do in a novel is I am quite an emotional writer, and I do try to bring it to a place where there'll be sort of a, you know, to be an emotional cathartic moment. But I do genuinely think that, you know, I don't think it's my job to tell you how you should feel about the story.
Now, it occurs to me that, I don't know have you sold 5 million copies of Boy in the Stripe? Yeah.
Like
okay, it's entirely possible that everybody in this room has read this book. I've been in other rooms with people and John Boyne where everyone has read all his books. But just in case there's anybody here who hasn't yet, and it's a treat, and I encourage you to do so, but can you explain very briefly what you do in The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas in terms of that dual relationship?
Between the two boys?
Yeah. And also what you do in terms of presenting the Holocaust through that thing. Because in some sense, The Absolutist is a reversal of what you did in the earlier book.
These two books, The Absolutist and The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, are both about the same thing in many ways. They're both about two young males who meet in a wartime setting, become friends with tragic consequences. And you might not believe this, but when I wrote The Absolutist, it was only as I was doing the rewrites that I began to make that connection with the earlier novel. I had never quite connected it. And then I started to see all the links between them. With Striped Pyjamas, and with this, you're talking about two situations, the Holocaust and the First World War, which have been written about and written about and written about. And there's no point writing about them unless you have a new way to tell the story and something new to say and something surprising. And with Striped Pyjamas, the idea was that all the novels I had read, and I've been a student of the Holocaust for many years, it is a subject that always fascinated me, all the novels I had read had, naturally enough, been written from the perspective of the Jewish characters. And I hadn't read a novel written by, or not written by, but from the perspective. different way. And again, one of the criticisms, another of the criticisms of the book was, how could Bruno not know what was happening in front of him? But of course, when that was going on, the truth about the Holocaust didn't come out until about sort of 46, 47. It was going on in front of the world. Inmates were being taken through forests, you know, in Poland, and people were seeing it, and nobody was saying anything. You know, Bruno is representing, when he walks to that fence and looks across and sees the people on the other side of the fence, that is what the world was doing at the time. So it seemed quite credible to me. But even as a fiction writer and somebody with a reasonably good imagination, I felt, I don't want to write this novel from inside the fence and just copy what I have read from all the great Holocaust literature that I have read. I've got to find this new way. And that was the way to do it.
What was the correlative impetus? Because what I meant when I said it was reversing was, it seems to me in Boy in Striped Pyjamas, you're finding a new way of looking at the Holocaust by seeing it through the prism of these two children on either side of the fence. But I was sort of expecting you to say about The Absolutist that you wanted to write about the torment and difficulty of gay love and found that the First World War was a really useful context to do that. Mm. So whilst I recognise that you can read the two as sort of a pair or a complementary set of books, they are crucially written for, on the one hand, a children's readership, and on the other hand, an adult readership. Yeah. Given that we are now familiar with, when revisiting historical contexts, modern novelists writing specifically more graphically about sex.
Mm-hmm.
Why is there... So this is a totally unreasonable
why is there no
question.
Sex in the
why
book?
Is there not more sex, given that the two crucial moments of this boy's life are about sex?
So my mother's going to read it. So, I don't know. I think, you know, I thought about that at the start. You know, I thought how deeply am I going to go into the sexual side of the book. I think I don't feel comfortable writing that. I didn't want it to be about sex. I wanted it to be about love. You know, that it's about passion and somebody you can't have. Because even though he does get him, you know, a couple of times, he really can't have this relationship. There's no reason for it. It's just gratuitous.
Well, I don't know if you object to gratuitous sex. We're clearly not on the same page. When you've written two books like this, there is a not unreasonable expectation from the audience that you are not miserable, but you're not writing a bundle of laughs here, John.
Yeah.
You tend towards, and you are, I suppose, drawn towards the most difficult, the most pain that you can find. Is that something you recognise, or are these subjects...
There are things, and I think any novelist would say this, there are things that when you look back at the books you've written, you recognise running themes, or you recognise something that you do as a writer, but that you haven't set out at the start thinking this is who I am. And I do look back now. In fact, there's a third one, because there's the new children's book, which is, I think, just published here, which is a companion piece to The Absolutist, also set during the First World War and featuring some of the characters. And it's also quite sad. I am drawn to that. I've only written one book which has laughs in it, and that's Barnaby Brockett, a children's book. But that even in itself is really, that whole book is a children's book about, it's a metaphor for being gay in a children's book. And I don't know why I write about sad things all the time. I do like to move the reader. You know, I feel that there's writers who write from the head and writers who write from the heart. There's intellectual writers and emotional writers. And I don't think I'm a very intellectual writer. I don't think I'm a very, and I don't mean this in a disingenuous way. I don't think I'm a smart, you know, the one thing I hate is when somebody says to me about, say, something like Striped Pyjamas, it was very clever. I don't like a book to be clever. As a reader, I don't want to read clever. I want to read beautiful language, and I want to be moved. I want to have a real strong emotional reaction to a story. And I that is who I always think I will continue to be as a writer. I will write not necessarily sad stories, but just honest stories. And honest stories, you know, life is hard, life is sad.
Can you conceive of writing a celebratory, joyful book about being gay?
Oh, for sure. And that would be a great idea, yeah. Well, I think I did in Barnaby, because, you know, if you've read Barnaby, Barnaby is it's a story set today about a little boy who's born into a family where the parents don't like anybody to be different in any way. They hate difference. And they have two children who are incredibly normal. And then they have this little child, Barnaby, and Barnaby floats. He doesn't obey the law of gravity. And his parents despise him for floating. And they can't get him down off the ceiling. And eventually, when he's 8 years old, they're so embarrassed by him. They carry him around on a like a kite, you know, a string. And they're so embarrassed by him that, you know, they cut it. And off Barnaby floats off into the world. And they exile him from their family because he floats. And the idea behind that book was, you know, using floating as a metaphor in that way. But Barnaby, throughout the whole book, no matter all the bad things that happen to him and all the meanness that goes on, is never anything other than cheerful, optimistic, positive. And when towards the end of the book there are options in his way, Barnaby realizes, actually, you know what, he loves floating. This is who he is. This is the way he was born, and he doesn't need to change for anybody. So, you know, that message and that novel is one I actually feel quite fulfills that in some way.
Can I just ask a couple of really technical questions
Sure.
about this? You have said that you rushed down a first draft to just nail the story. And when you say that what you want from a book is beautiful language and an emotional rip that will hook you and change the way you react and therefore the way you live and the way you might be as a reader, how much of that beautiful language, that emotional woomph, I'm just wondering how they're going to translate woomph there, but you know what I mean. How much of that comes in the second and the third and the fourth draft? Because it is, the language is spectacularly beautiful. There are moments of exquisite poetry, and you might not want to say they're clever, but they're bloody brilliant. And what do you put them in, or is that the way you render it?
Well, they're two different things. The emotion, I think, is there from the first draft. For me, writing the first draft so quickly, all day long, every day, for, you know, about a month, is it puts me right into the story. I'm so focused on it that the plot and the, because I don't know what's going to happen. I genuinely make it up as I go along, and it. I feel that the emotion and the plot all comes naturally in it. The language, no. I do about sort of usually somewhere between 12 and 15 drafts of a novel. And the first draft of the novel is not well written in any sense. It's just a story being put down. After that, you know, I don't know what the novel is about when I start it. I know what the novel is about when I finish the first draft. And then I know, okay, now this is what I have to do to fix this. And that's when I start working on the language. And that's my favorite part. I find the first draft a somewhat painful experience because it's so hard, it's so difficult. And I love it when I finish it. And then I can just focus on a page here and a page here and just keep rewriting it, reading it out loud, trying to make every word, every sentence as good as it can possibly be. And that's more important to me. You know, that's something that's really... I really, really want it to be... this is probably an obvious thing to say, but I, you know, I'm a writer. I want it to be well-written. I want people to be surprised by images and language along the way. But it takes a long time to get that.
This is slightly unfair for people who haven't already read this, but can I just take this book specifically? Mm-hmm. I'm astounded that you knocked out a first draft, as you say, in a month. That's all it took?
Oh, probably about 3 weeks. 2 or 3 weeks, yeah.
Do you write like 20 hours a day?
I'd write for about, on a first draft, I would write for about 12 hours a day, all day, 7 days a week.
Okay, what happened?
I think Ishiguro writes his first drafts in 10 days or something. I think I read that somewhere.
Okay.
Boy in the Striped Pajamas, I wrote that first draft in 2.5 days. 60 hours without sleep. Started on a Wednesday morning, 9 o'clock, wrote all the way through Wednesday, realized if I walked away from it, I was going to lose it, lose the story, wrote through Wednesday night, wrote through Thursday night, finished at lunchtime on Friday. True story. Finished it then. And on the Tuesday morning, I hadn't even thought of the story. It just came to me on the Tuesday evening, and I thought, I better write this. And Friday, it was my birthday on the Friday, and I finished the first draft in 2.5 days after I started it.
God, you're an academic's fantasy. you didn't by any miracle just handwrite it, did you?
No, I typed it.
Drafts and drafts. Yeah. What happened to this book in the 10th, 11th, 12th draft? What are you doing by then? Is it just polishing language, or are you...
No, I think it's the characters are changing, because... I think in the first draft, if I remember right, in the first draft, Tristan was much more of a heroic figure, and he was much more likable. And I think Will was a little bit more, not the villain of the piece, but he was somebody who had hurt Tristan. And because of the way the novel ends, which I won't give away, I realized that's not right. That's not going to work. And I need to make them, get back to that spectrum where of kindness and cruelty and blended a bit more. So Tristan got a bit harder as times went on. Will got a bit nicer. What else changed? The in the war scenes itself, one thing I was concerned with at the start was I wanted it to be... there's two chapters, really, which take place in the war, and each of them has about 10 scenes. And I wanted it to feel like it wasn't a running narrative, that it was... that it would feel like it was a mix-up of memories, that they could all have happened at different times. It's like that B.S. Johnson thing of throwing up all the chapters in the air and letting them all fall, and you could read the novel in any order. And I wanted those scenes to feel like that. I wanted it to feel like just moments, not a running story. So some of them weren't even there at the first draft. Some of them would have got put in later. Some of them would have got deleted. But I think the most thing was probably
they're all written in the present tense, aren't
yes.
they?
Yes. And I wanted that immediacy. I felt if the wartime scenes are written in the present tense, it would be... I wanted you to feel like you were really there. I wanted it to feel as immediate as possible.
And the overwhelming sense of damage done to a generation is unresolved, is... You don't give anyone an easy out from this. The parents don't understand the children. The men don't understand the women, and the women don't understand the men.
Yeah.
It's a massive kind of aggregation of failure of human relationships, as the war was a great aggregation of failure of human diplomacy.
Which is the result of a war. And, that's the whole point, that... the war comes to an end, but it's not over at all, and obviously it's going to start up again in 20 years' time. But in the meantime, all these people are all, their lives have been destroyed one way or the other.
Can I ask one last question, which is a slightly cheeky question, just before we open this to the audience? And that is, John, almost all the male characters, and indeed the two leading female characters, have very particularly described hair.
Do they?
We know pretty much exactly. And I just, casually wondered how important that was to you.
That's something no one's ever said to me before. Never heard that. I wonder, does that run through all the books? I don't know.
No, it doesn't. It's very particularly this one. But from Sylvia's amazing chevelure... to Rigby's close ginger crop.
And
you get Peter's elegantly Rupert Everetted.
Yeah. I'm obviously overcompensating for a lack of hirsuteness.
John Boyne, thank you very much. We have a quarter of an hour for questions from you. I am incredibly short-sighted, so if when the lights go up, you'd like to ask a question, could you wave your hand? And I think there are microphones that will come to you. And now I can't... Oh, there's a question down the front here, if someone could bring a microphone.
Hello, and thank you for for that fantastic discussion. There were some fantastic questions asked, and I loved your answers too. I haven't yet read The Absolutist, but obviously I've read The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, and you've talked of the letters that you receive from your readers. Mm. And given the context and the content of Boy in Striped Pyjamas, I wondered what the emotional reactions you received from children.
It's different between children and adults, I have to say, because, I mean, obviously that's the book I received the most mail about. Most of the messages I get from children are usually related to classroom work, where, you know, I will receive like 30 letters in an envelope from a classroom who's been studying the book, and they often ask questions about the things which are unsaid in the book. For example, what happened to Pavel the waiter? What happened to Lieutenant Kotler? And when I go into classrooms, which I've done a lot, that's what they always ask as well. And I always say back to them, well, what do you think happened to them? Usually they feel a great emotional connection to Bruno particularly. I would say that's not quite the same in the letters I receive from adults, because they tend to be... adults don't tend to write to say they like something. Adults are more... in terms of Striped Pyjamas, I would get more negative letters and emails about that, I would say. But that's okay most of the time.
They've bought the book.
I get some strange reactions sometimes. You know, I got one recently where a woman got in touch with me to say she'd read Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, and this is a mistake in the book, that Bruno's grandmother at one point in the book sings Livion Rose, but Livion Rose was written in 1946. So okay, it's a mistake, and I acknowledge it. But she said she read the book, and what she wanted to say was that this ruined the book for her. And I thought, you know, my response was like, if you read a book like that with that subject matter and that ending, and that's the thing that you have the problem with, you know, I don't quite understand the mentality there. That's your problem? That you don't like the fact that she sung a song? I don't understand that kind of criticism particularly. But and I've never quite got the whole you're sympathizing with the Nazis thing, which I've had quite a bit as well. But I'm sure there are flaws in the writing, which means...
Next question from here, and then could we have one from somebody somewhere else?
Good afternoon. I'm very impressed with your brightness and your sensitivity. I would like to ask you, how do you feel about being in a country like Colombia, which is so different to your country? How do you feel about ever writing about South America, Central America, which might be the future of humanity? How do you feel being here? This is so different for you.
Yeah.
Or is it?
Oh, no, it is. It's very different for me. For one thing, the sun is out.
John Boyne is appearing for the Irish Tourist Board, ladies and gentlemen.
I mean, one of the great joys, if you're fortunate enough to get published and to do okay at it, is getting to travel the world and come places like this. And because I'm a writer who, to date, has centered all of my fiction outside of my home country, these visits are actually very important to me. Most Irish writers, if not all Irish writers, write about Ireland. And I never have to date, although my next adult novel, which is coming at the end of this year, is entirely set in Ireland for the first time. But I've never done that. So these visits... They show up in the novels I write. You know, you go somewhere, you see a different world, you see a different culture, you try and understand it a little bit. You know, we were talking earlier backstage about wishing that there was more, that English language publishing would translate more, which it doesn't, which is a shame, because you want to read your peers from that country. So it's great to be here. And I have to say, this is an incredible place. I feel like I'm in that movie Amadeus. You know, it's like... I don't think I've ever spoken in a venue like this before.
Thank you.
Sorry, who else would like to ask a question? I'm quite happy to carry on myself, but it's your turn.
Somebody at the back.
Up at the back there.
Hi, John. My question is, what would your advice be to people who want to, like, who are aspiring writers and really enjoy writing historical fiction? Like, what would your advice be?
Okay, a couple of pieces of advice. I remember a few years ago I mentioned teaching at University of East Anglia. I was teaching a bunch of, I'd say it was about 12 or 13 young people who all wanted to be writers. And the first day in class, I went around the room and asked them all what they were reading at the moment. And I think about 9 or 10 of them hadn't read a book in about 6 months. And you'd be surprised at the amount of young people who say they want to be writers who don't read. So that's the first thing. When it comes to historical fiction, the place I start when I start a novel is not with nonfiction. I read novels which were written at the time that my novel is set. Because if you do that, you find language and idiom that has fallen by the wayside, that you can steal, you know, that you can bring back into the book.
Pay homage.
You find all this little detail of, I'm always looking for things like, you know, does a man stand up when a woman walks into the room? You know, how do people travel? What do they eat? What are they wearing? What is their hair like? So I start with novels. That's where I begin. And then I move into the nonfiction. So, and I always think if you're going to write about history, that's a pretty good place to start.
Yeah, question down here, please. Can you imagine sitting in Britain having an audience asking questions in Spanish to a Spanish author? You are phenomenal,
yes,
you
thank
people.
You.
Buenas tardes. Mi pregunta es sobre...
Okay. That was just... I was asking for that, wasn't I?
Mi pregunta es sobre la adaptación cinematográfica de su novela, El niño con el pijama de rayas, La cercanía.
Hang on,
I have to go
one
back
second,
to start. So. Okay, start again.
First. La adaptación cinematográfica de su novela El niño con el pijama de rayas, ¿cuál fue la cercanía con el proceso de adaptación, el trabajo con quien realiza la adaptación y su conformidad respecto a la finalización de ese proceso, ya la película en pantalla que tanto le complace conforme a la idea original?
Yeah, I was quite close to it. The writer and director Mark Herman, he would send me every draft of the book. Of the screenplay, which he wasn't obliged to do. But I made a decision at the start of the process, because I'd had friends who had gone through this experience before. And people always think that the writer needs to learn to trust the filmmakers. But it's the other way around. The filmmakers need to learn to trust the writer, that you're not going to be annoying, you're not going to be precious about it. Once you've signed that contract, you've given it over. And I thought at the start, the more helpful I am, the more positive I am, the more chance that if I have something that I really feel strongly about, the more chance they will listen to me. So that was the approach I took. So with each draft that would come to me, I would focus on the positives and then ask some questions at the end, say, a couple of things here. Ultimately, I thought he did a really, really strong adaptation. The main difference between the book and the movie is the book is all from the point of view of the child, and the movie broadens it out to be about the family, which I think you need to do, because I don't think you could be running along with Bruno for 100 minutes. So I think it's quite interesting to see the more of the family life. And one other thing that Mark did, which I really liked, was, and I think this is great in an adaptation, where you take something on the page and you change it, but you're still telling it. There's a scene in the book where Bruno's sister, Gretel, has taken all the dolls out of her room and replaced them with maps of Europe, and she's following the armies across Europe because she has a crush on Lieutenant Kotler. And in the book, Bruno runs upstairs, runs into Gretel's room, and he sees this, and he's surprised, which is fine. But actually, in the movie, what Mark did is actually better, because what he did was Bruno loses his football. His mother says she thinks it's in the basement. He goes down to the basement. The lights aren't working, so he turns on a torch, and he moves the torch around the room. And as he does this, it finds the piled-up naked bodies of the dolls from Gretel's room. And of course, that's reflecting what's going on the other side of the fence. And it's such a powerful visual image. And it was one of those moments I thought, I wish I had thought of that. That would be great, you know. But it works so well on screen. And I think that's the best kind of adaptation, where you're not slavish to the book, but you respect the book. It was a really positive experience in my life.
Do you ever get to go back and revise and think, I wish I'd thought of that when you have new editions of other books.
No, I haven't read any of my books since they were published. And I don't want to read them. Because the way I feel, there's 12 of them now, and each one of them is in my head in a different way, and I have a different view of them. And there are some that I think what I set out to achieve, I did achieve. And there are some I think I didn't. Of course, there are some failures along the way. And I don't want to know if I'm right or wrong. I remember reading recently that when Philip Roth said he was retiring, he went back to read all his books, but he went backwards. He read his most recent one. He went all the way back. He stopped at his fourth book because he thought at that point they were getting dreadful. Of course, they're not dreadful, but he thought they were. And I sort of had it in my head that maybe when I'm an old man, maybe I will read them then. But you read them so much. It's like, you know, Woody Allen says that he's never seen any of his movies since he made them because he spends a year shooting them, editing them, watching them over and over and over. I've reread these books so many times during the writing of them. I don't want to go back to them. And I will only see the flaws anyway. I will only see the things that are wrong, sentences that are not as good as they could have been. And I would rather just let them be.
Okay. Sorry, I know it's your turn. Question down here, please.
Buenas tardes. I would like to know about your book, El Niño de Pijama Rayas. No sé en inglés.
The Boy in the Striped
Pajamas. The Boy
pajamas.
In the Striped Pajamas. Yes. I have a curiosity about it. I like so much the scene when you describe how they discovered camp concentration from the view, from the frame of the window. I would like to know how do you create this scene, because to me is the main, is the basement for the rest, for the complete, for the whole book, because it's about it. It's about the view from the frame of the comfortable house from the innocent eyes, from the childish, the view from of this horror, this adult horror. So I would like to know if you read something, if you hear about it, something similar, or just is coming from your imagination.
Yeah, no, it's just from the imagination. You know, you start the story. I knew where I was going as such, that it was going to begin with a child being taken away from a place of safety, which is his home. And a lot of children's literature begins like that, and brought to an unusual place that he doesn't understand. But I knew, of course, where the setting was. I knew where he was going. And I wanted that, like, people who read that book early on, who knew nothing about it, would go on the same journey as Bruno. And there'd be a point where you would realize where you were. So I didn't want to give away too many clues too early on. So I moved them into the house, and I thought this is the place now where Bruno can look out, and he'll see this fence, and he'll see people wearing uniforms of what he perceives to be striped pajamas. It was just the natural progression of the story, and in fact, that was the moment, I think, where I can remember scribbling down on a piece of paper at my desk, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, as a title. Because I knew that Bruno would ultimately be wearing a pair of these striped pajamas, but it was just a way for him to look across. You know, he jumps on his bed and looks out the window, and there it is. It's in the distance.
We've got time for one more question, if anybody would like to ask it, or I happily will. Okay. All right, gentleman there.
Thank you. I will try to put it into English.
Okay.
It is just a curiosity. I never knew you before, but what you explain about your way of writing, it looks to me like you are a very organized writer. On the other hand, there are so many writers who are publishing a book, rewriting it 10, 12, 15 times in the history. If you look to Balzac, a French writer, it's incredible. And I would just, as a matter of curiosity, ask you, is it just the way you feel, the way you are, or do you believe there is an advantage in your way of dropping a book after you have read it or published it? Or do you envy something in the way of a writer redoing all the time the same thing?
Yeah. I don't really understand what impulse would lead somebody to rewrite a published book. It's part of your life. It's who you were as a person, as a writer, where you were in your emotional life at the time you wrote it. And there are so many other stories to tell. So I don't really understand that impulse. I am very organized. I'm very disciplined. I'm very focused. But the thing you must remember is I absolutely love what I do. I love writing. It's a huge, it defines me. If I'm not working on the novel, I feel lost in some way. That's why I write so much, you know, because it's what I do. I don't have anything else to do. You know, that's my job. All writers are different, but I don't understand writers who publish a book every 10 years. Life is short. Dickens published a book every year. I don't see why other people can't.
A little unfair. I mean, you're pitching him awfully high here. Not everybody can, measure up to Dickens.
I tell you, Peter, what I don't like is you know the way when sometimes people publish books and the publishers and the author makes a virtue of the fact that it took them 8 years to write? You know, that doesn't make a book better that it took 8 years to write. It doesn't. You know, it might be better, but it might not. You know, a book that you write in 8 weeks could be better. A book is ready when it's ready. It's that simple, and all writers work differently. But I know that for myself, I have a lot of stories I want to tell, and I want to keep moving. What's next? I don't want to look backwards.
You say that that's all of your job, but actually, we're incredibly lucky that you're here, because you could be at any one of 54 other literary festivals somewhere in the world that you get invited to every week. How much of this bit do you actually enjoy?
I like this bit. I like talking about books. I like answering questions about books with an audience of readers. I like that a lot. I don't like doing interviews, press interviews, because I tell you what the problem is, and I'm sure I apologize to any journalists in the audience, but I do find that when you publish a new book, if you have a big book behind you like Striped Pajamas, that's what people keep coming back to and want to talk about. And it's kind of lazy. And, you know, if I can go through the rest of my life without anybody saying, where did you get the idea for The Boy in Striped Pajamas, I think I would be happy, you know.
Can I just point out, you brought it up, not me.
No, I know, that's true. I did, you're right. You're right. But I like meeting readers. You know, I wouldn't say it's lonely, but it's, you know, there's a solitude to writing stories. And you want people to read them. You know, I don't want to write into a void. I don't underestimate the fantastic nature of coming to a place on the other side of the world and sitting in a room like this and looking out at a view like this. It's incredible to me. You know, getting off the plane yesterday, going through the airport in Bogota, and I saw my book in the window of a bookshop in the airport, and I just said to my sister at the time, it's mad. Like, you know, you think you're sitting in Dublin writing these novels, and people on the other side of the world are interested. And I don't underestimate that, and I feel very grateful for that, actually. So
That's part of the answer to your really great question about how do you feel about being here. And part of the answer to that is familiar, because the global reading community is reciprocal, and it respects any truths that are told that appear to be true to all of us, which is why great literature is so phenomenal. We've run out of time, but John is going to be signing books afterwards in the lobby. Can I recommend to all of you, who I'm sure will want him to sign your copies of his books, that he is magpie-like, and like all writers who come to this beautiful country, is not given enough of Colombian literature. So if there are any Colombian books and writers that you would like to recommend to him, do please pass them on while he's signing. Thank you for being such a great audience. And John Boyne, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks.